You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Curtain up, theater people, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket, coming to you from the Hell's Kitchen area of Midtown Manhattan, right in the middle of Broadway. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. Your Program Is Your Ticket is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. As many of you know, and if you don't, let me explain it to you, Your Program Is Your Ticket is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater in smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on this show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. I love theater and see as much as I can wherever I go. During the travels of the production of My Husband and My Play at The Flash, I have met many wonderful people from all over the world in the theater community, and it is my honor to bring them on as guests to the show. Tonight's guest is mega-talented and hilariously, emphasis on hilarious, funny writer and actor Eileen Fisher. I'll be bringing Eileen on in a few minutes, but first I'd like to take a moment or two to talk about the evolution of this year's Tony nominees for Best Play. I've just discussed this before, the at times unnoticed groundwork that a Broadway show does and works on and has even before it gets to Broadway. So I thought I would, you know, sort of give a little bit of lineage of that with the current slate that we have of Tony nominees. Often they're subjected to or brought through off-Broadway or out-of-town tryouts or even just, you know, readings in a theater or somebody's house or living room sometimes. These shows can be in development for years. Some of them have the same talent performing the show for that length of time and making continuous adjustments. So sometimes you'll see a Broadway play and you won't realize that the cast has been doing that for years and years and years, even before opening night. If they're lucky enough. So I think that they would, most actors wouldn't mind that at all. So here we go. With this year's play nominees, there's a play out there called Indecent. I believe it's by Paula Vogel, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. FYI, it had its world premiere at Yale Repertory Theater in October 2015, so like a year and a half ago. Then it played a limited engagement at La Jolla Playhouse, which is by San Diego, from November 13th to December 10th of 2015. Then the play had its New York premiere off-Broadway at the Vineyard Theater with an opening night of May 17th, 2016. And then finally, after following previews from April 27th, it opened, and it's doing such great work and is getting great buzz and great press, and it got nominated for a Tony. And I believe it's winning also, like, off-Broadway awards as well, so I should probably look that up. Anyways, the next play is called Oslo. I actually saw Oslo. I loved it. It actually had its world premiere production in July 11th, 2016 at the Mitzi E. Newhouse Theater, which is one of the smaller theaters at Lincoln Center. And it's actually closed, and then it transferred over to the big theater in Lincoln Center. It's a great play, and I remember when it was off-Broadway, I really, really wanted a ticket, and I could never get one because it was always sold out. So, the next production I want to talk about is called Sweat, and Sweat is a play that just recently won the Pulitzer Prize for drama, so that's fabulous. It first opened at Oregon Shakespeare Festival in 2015 before playing at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., and then it opened off-Broadway on October 18th at the Public Theater. And then finally, it had a December 18th Broadway transfer. It's crazy. So, anyways, I am really, really excited to see that play because the author of that play also wrote a play called Ruin that won the Pulitzer Prize, and I loved that play. It was amazing. I saw it twice. In California. So there you go. Anyways, the fourth play is called A Doll's House Part 2, and this is a play that was commissioned by South Coast Repertory Theater, which is in Costa Mesa, California. I worked right across the street from it in a restaurant, and where it has a production that's directed by Shelley Butler. The play opened on Broadway on April 27th, and it's at the John Golden Theater. And one of the really interesting things about this play is that for a time, and it may still be happening, but it ran both here at the John Golden Theater on Broadway and also at South Coast Repertory Theater at the same time, which I don't know if that's ever happened before. Probably somewhere along the lines of Broadway history, but that is very, very rare. Although this has pretty much gone to Broadway, since the two shows are running concurrently on both coasts, the playwright, his name is Lucas Nath, he has proven himself to be a brilliant talent in shows like The Christians, which I saw, which was like a meditation on church. So he is one of those playwrights who you know, I will fangirl over if I ever meet him. And he has proven himself to be able to open a play. And that's a great play, by the way. Loved it. Saw that. So anyways, there you go. And now you know that when you're seeing a Broadway play, most of the time it's had three or four productions before that. And so, okay. Now anyways, I would like to bring on our guest. She is one of the funniest people I've ever met in my entire life. And also an incredible writer. So please welcome the sensational Eileen Fisher. Hi, Eileen, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Hello, Sean. Thanks for having me.
And she's actually right here. Right here in front of me.
Right here.
I know. You're the third in-person interview that I've had on Your Program Is Your Ticket. It's so nice to be able to reach out and touch these people.
It's a beautiful thing. I wish you'd worn pants, though. He's naked.
Yeah. Actually, I'm wearing a pencil skirt right now. Okay, so David and I met Eileen back in 2012 when we were doing our play Out the Flash in Chicago for its world premiere. We moved out there for a couple months because David acts in the play as well as being one of the writers. And we were in rehearsals, and during that time, Pride Films and Plays, who produced the show, did a program called the Women's Work Festival. Women's Words Festival.
Women's Work.
Women's Work. Okay, thank you. And so Eileen had a show in that festival, I believe it was called Jilted. And so we met. We met while they were doing the readings of all the finalists.
It was a short screenplay.
A short screenplay.
Is what
okay.
It was, yeah. Okay, cool. And they were doing a reading of it. So I was like, I grew up in Chicago, and I thought, well, this will be fun. I'm going to go to Chicago and witness this.
And how fun it was, because then we got to meet you, and it was like platonic gay man, lesbian woman love at first sight.
Totally.
So totally, and we've been friends ever since. And so it's really cool that happened. I'm very very happy because I love having lots of writers, and I love when they're my friends too. So, anyways, Eileen, tell us a little bit about yourself and your creative theater passion.
Gosh. Well, for me, it's really been, the passion's really about comedy, mm-hmm. at least for me in terms of what I create. I mean, I love a good drama. I mean, I'm a lesbian, of course, I love a good drama. But in terms of what I'm creating, it always starts out as funny and usually turns dark. Like most funny things come from dark places.
Sure.
So my training has really been more in when I was in high school. I lied about my age and said I was 18 so I could take classes at Second City. And I started taking improv when I was a senior in high school, and I was like the baby in the improv class. And it was then my brother would come and pick me up, and I'd be in Spanish class the next morning. And it was weird, but it was awesome. And that's sort of where I really learned the tenets of improv, and that has served me. It served me as a person, certainly. You know, I mean, how many commencement addresses are there by former improvisers who are always saying, "And the first rule of life is yes and." And there's absolutely some truth to that. But I've found as a writer, too, when I'm, you know, I won't outline something necessarily as much as I'll play an improv game with myself while I'm writing. With, you know, I get to a point and I'd say, well, what's the next thing that should happen here?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, you know, I kind of know the direction I'm going in, but it's not necessarily plotted out. It's sort of more improvised. And that's that foundation training that I got way back when I was a young adult has really laid that groundwork for me professionally. And when I watch things, I can still apply a lot of what I learned then. And then what I did, like most theater people, I didn't get into some prestigious theater programs. So I was a communications major,
mm-hmm.
and really found a love for TV and film production.
Ah.
And upon graduating from college, I was living in Boston and working in public television, and I started doing improv again. And I ended up I was in a class for a year, and our teacher was like, "You guys are really funny. You should become a troupe." And we're like, okay. So they're like, "You know, you need a business manager." And it was like that Three Stooges thing where, you know, the two of them step backwards, and as opposed to somebody stepping forward, everybody else steps backwards, and you're the one left. So I became the business manager by turning around going, "Where did everybody go?"
By being slow on the uptake. Yeah,
duh. So I ended up running this troupe as well as being a principal actor in it for 7 years. And that was a hell of an experience on artistically and professionally and, you know, lifelong friends. And
I'm sure.
And just really, but every aspect of it, because I was in it from the first day to the last day. And just all the people who had come through it over the years and the work that we did and how we grew, you know, in the 7 years that we were together from how we were able to just improvise. When you're a really good improviser, that's when you get to break the rules. Oh. You get to say no, but, because if you're working with somebody you really trust, you're really saying yes and. It just sounds like no, but.
Oh, my gosh.
But that's like, and I probably couldn't do that today because I haven't been on an improv stage in a long time, but there have been scenes where it looks like you're denying somebody, but you're really not. And it's that level of improv skill that's really, it's a remarkable thing to watch. And, you know, you can still, there are plenty of improvisers who are really good at that.
Well, it's like, isn't it all about like shifting the scene or the direction of the scene into a new direction if it's starting to stale a little bit?
When you're really in it, you're not even, when you're really in it and you're just, you don't know where you are. It's not even, everything becomes instinctual. And if you trust the people that you're on stage with, you know that it might dip, but it's never going to really lull. Mm. And if it really lulls, someone else, if you're all in tune, will jump in and either make a new scene, depending on the structure that you're doing, or add the thing that's needed in the moment.
Oh, cool.
It's magic. When it works, it's magic. When it doesn't work, it's...
Oh, it's painful. You know who it's most painful for? The audience. Yeah. Because we're all aware that, like, oh my God, this is going off the rails. But I think that's
it's pretty tough from on stage too, because you're like, we're losing them, we're going down, get the nose up, and it's like she's going down.
You're going for like the nose here, you're like pull back, I can't.
We need a wind,
right? That's really a great theory about writing, because when you're writing, I always say, is like a million choices until it's down to like two or three.
Right.
So you're always going, okay, what's the next line? Mm-hmm. And I never even put the concept of being strong at improv together with that. So that's an amazing theory.
There's a short form improv game that it's probably called something else now because I did improv a long time ago. That was called Options. And it was essentially a scene would happen and there'd be a facilitator. Mm-hmm. And you'd get to a point where you were in a funny position or you drank or you performed some sort of action. You know, you picked up something or you drank something and the facilitator would say, freeze. And they'd ask the audience essentially what happens next. You know, they'd say, Sean has a reaction to what he's drinking. What is it? You know, or she thought she picked up a shovel, but it's really and then the audience will answer that question. And whether, you know, it's a feather or a cinder block, then you just commit to what the audience says and, you know, and it's a go. And then you just pick it up with that. And then you have to react to that new thing.
Oh, wow.
And so when I'm writing and I don't know where I'm going, I'm just playing options with myself.
Oh,
you know, it's like, I've come to the end of the scene. What happens now? You know, so.
And so tell me, at what age did you realize that writing and acting and improv was a passion for you and you knew that you had to pursue it?
Here's the story that I usually tell. My father was a stand-up comedian. When I was a kid, I grew up in Chicago, and he used to perform at this resort in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. It is just as romantic as it sounds. Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, near Sheboygan. And it was Wisconsin, you know. It was a lake, and
Hang on, I'm booking a trip there. Yeah.
I've actually, checked the website, and back in the day, it's called something else. Back then, it was Schwartz's Resort, the Schwartz Resort.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Okay.
So I used to call it the Catskills of the Midwest. My father performed on cruise ships and in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin.
Okay.
I, as a youngin, knew my father's act. I'm talking five. And so one day during the Kitty Talent show, I decided to get up and do one of my father's jokes, which, of course, I did not understand. But I knew his cadence. I knew his delivery. And according to my mother, I knew how to hold a microphone and milk a laugh.
This I can believe.
So I went up there and I did a couple of my dad's jokes. And then the story goes, because honestly, I am too young to remember this. A couple days later when my father performed, he wasn't getting any laughs.
Oh, gosh.
And he's like, what the hell? And someone's like, Ed, you need to keep an eye on your kid. So the stage thing, the audience thing happened really young. Mm-hmm. You know, I really dug that. And so, you know, I didn't really... school plays kind of thing. I just didn't really go to schools that had them. You know, there wasn't really a drama club. But when I was in high school, we used to write our own play, actually, which was fun. But that was, you know, so one year myself and my then boyfriend wrote a...
This was a long time.
This was a long time right. ago. Wrote a film noir kidnapping mystery called Here's Looking for You, Kid. And the music that we did, because it was a musical, were all... popular song parodies of the time. So there are certain 80s songs that when I hear them still, I replace them with the lyrics that we wrote for them.
That is the ultimate derivative musical. I love it.
Yeah, so that's what we did. And, you know, because we had to involve, this was the 80s.
Sure.
And so someone gets kidnapped and we had to involve the police. So you know who they were. I mean, that was the kind of stuff we did. But it was pretty fun.
So since the age of five... when you did your father's stand-up act. Now, you know what my next question is going to be, right?
No, I don't.
Okay. Do you remember any of the jokes that you told?
I remember his entire act.
Okay, tell me the best joke.
See...
And by the way, the show is marked explicit on iTunes, okay. So...
See, well, here's the thing. My father... My parents were married in 1959. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was... My father was born in 1929.
Okay.
So he was doing comedy, you know, this is late 60s, 70s. And he was doing comedy when he was younger in the 50s. That's the material I don't know. My father used to play the Playboy clubs when they existed.
Wow.
So I'm sure my father had blue material.
Mm-hmm.
As he was a big fat guy. And, you know, I'm sure there was a whole other unarchived, you know, material that I don't know. By the time the 70s came along and he was married with three children, you got to put it in context too. It was before sort of, you know, I mean, Lenny Bruce was doing Lenny, you know, and Richard Pryor and all that was happening, but comics were still pretty... generic in their material.
And tame, I'm sure.
And so it wasn't quite, you know, he wasn't political, none of that, you know. So it was sort of like, it wasn't quite guy walks into a bar kind of humor.
Uh-huh.
But it was. You know, you'd throw names on there to make them a little more interesting. But essentially, so I was with my wife the other day. Now you've got me not finishing sentences.
That's okay.
Because he did a whole routine about my mother being Italian, which she was not. and he did this whole routine about their wedding night, which... It's really horrible and offensive, but there's still, so he would end with, basically, I was going to tell you one joke about the toilet seat, but I'm not going to.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that as a teaser for when I come back.
Okay.
Due to audience demand.
Okay, I'm writing it down.
The toilet seat
joke. Okay.
He would do this whole routine about my mother being this big fat Italian lady named Shirley Constanza, which...
Shirley Constanza?
My mother's name was Joan. She was a nice Jewish lady from the North Side. But this was his bit. And he did this whole thing about their wedding night and how she was Italian. And basically he made her Italian so he could do one joke, which was, she was Italian, I was Jewish. One day we'll have kids, they'll be Jew-ops.
Oh my God.
It was the 70s.
Right. Right.
One day a little Jew-op will come up to me and say, Daddy, I want a bicycle. What do I tell him? Steal it or buy it wholesale. Like, I still love that joke.
Oh my God.
It's hilarious.
Okay. Which is funny because in this day and age, that joke would be probably considered more offensive than like toilet humor.
Yeah.
But not your toilet joke, of course. Yeah. Like some of the sexual humor that we hear, and that's it. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Gosh, I love that. Okay, so would you consider improv and the acting that it spurred, or writing
mm-hmm.
your forte, your specialty? Which one of those would it be?
I don't understand the question.
Okay, well, like which. Okay, here's improv and acting.
Mm-hmm.
Here's writing.
Uh-huh.
Which would you consider to be your forte?
Right now it's writing. I've stepped off the stage. It's been a while since I've been on stage.
Okay.
And I, unlike my father, I enjoyed it, but I didn't crave it.
Ah.
You know, or unlike anybody who's, especially stand-ups and improvisers, who are doing their own material. I mean, that's the thing, too. I mean, I'm married to an actress, and she is a legit, for real, line-memorizing actress. And she loves it. And that's
and an excellent one.
And an excellent one.
Yeah.
If I don't say so myself. She's really pretty, too.
She is. She's totally pretty.
But she's, you know, and she's trained. She has a freaking MFA.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows her stuff, and it's... You know, to watch her prepare, she's like an athlete, you know, but with improv and with stand-up, it's, you're giving of yourself in a much different way.
Right.
You know, you're telling your own story, whether you're embellishing it or not, you're still starting from your own truth without a script. You know, you're creating that script from your own truth, which, you know, as an actor, you know, you're bringing your truth to someone else's truth.
Sure. Yeah.
And so all that to say, I didn't need, I don't get me wrong, I love being on stage, I love making people laugh, I love hearing that come at me.
Sure.
But I don't need it in a way that compels me to have pursued it, or I would have pursued it.
Right. So did it cool a little bit?
It did.
Yeah.
After I ran my improv troupe in Boston, and then I moved to LA, and I started doing stand-up in LA, also while writing spec scripts, and I wanted to be a TV writer.
Right. I was going to say you write for TV as well.
Ideally, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself not enjoying stand-up. Uh-huh. I've never really enjoyed stand-up as much as I enjoyed improv. I compare them to masturbating as opposed to having sex with a partner. That's my analogy for stand-up versus improv.
Which could be a great stand-up joke. Ironically. I don't know if that's irony or coincidence. I always confuse the two. Wow.
I've done some. My friends in Boston used to do a Valentine's Day show called Thorns. And that was kind of, I started doing those every Valentine's Day. And they invite me back every year, even though I don't live there anymore, because I was involved early on. And it's a great show. And I've done some really cool sort of more, I kind of fell into, I hate the term storytelling because it's used by people who aren't really storytellers. I think it's one of those, like, it's become a corporate jargon word, and I think people who really truly are at their core storytellers have kind of gotten swept up in this wave of, I'm a storyteller, because there's not a, because people don't have the right vocabulary for what they're doing. And
right.
So it sort of falls under this mishmash of storytelling.
It is a buzzword or a buzz phrase.
And so all that to say, the things that I was doing on Thorns were sort of more kind of personal. We used to call that personal monologues, you know. And again, it's just, it's an evolution of terminology more
right.
than it is a change in the way 10-minute plays used to be called sketches.
Right.
We're going to do a skit. No, it's a 10-minute play. It's a 5-minute play. It's a sketch. But so the things that we would do for Thorns were sort of, it was a good 5-8 minutes. It was a little more drawn out. It was the last one I did, which in the back of my head have always thought there was potential for. It was the history of my gay boyfriends, a PowerPoint presentation. Because
I'm remembering this now.
As a young girl, many of the boys that I had connected with were gay, the first being Barry Manilow and then working up from there. But again, this, we lived in a, where Sean and I are of the same age, pretty
mm-hmm,
much. So
right.
growing up in a generation where that
29.
Yeah. The 20s.
Right.
That where the vocabulary and the comfort wasn't, the openness just simply wasn't there, but we all still managed to find each other.
Right.
And because it was just, we were just a different quantum signature than the regular straight world.
Mm.
And we found each other. We just didn't, there weren't words yet. There weren't straight gay alliance groups yet. It was just sort of, I know that we connect and I don't know why. And so, you know, we think that we're boyfriend and girlfriend, but we're really not. You're
right.
gay and I'm gay, but we fit and we don't know why.
Huh.
And that's really what that piece is about, and how just, you know, going through my life, I've always had gay boyfriends, you know, sitting across from them.
Right. And it would be a PowerPoint, an actual
it
PowerPoint.
It actually was a PowerPoint
oh
presentation.
My gosh.
I had music. It was because it was pictures of, like, and here's another gay man. And
right.
You know, and then we can get with in-group, out-group humor about what words we can say and what words we can't, but.
Okay.
You know.
What messages and themes do you strive to convey to audiences through the pieces that you choose to write? Let's just stick with writing. And TV, film writing is fine too, stage writing. There are certain, I think we all have an identity or a voice as a writer. What's yours?
Well, the play that I did get produced, which started as a screenplay and ended up as a stage play, was called Girl Hopping.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of, it was about a group of lesbians in West Hollywood who were all one degree of separation of having slept with each other. And that came about as, I have a big problem with overwrought, overdramatic, processy lesbian theater and plays and books and movies and songs. I want to just grab the little lesbian by her tivas and shake her and say, stop it. And so Girl Hopping sort of came out of, was real life inspired by when I was living in Los Angeles and I was sort of met kind of the showbiz lesbian mafia. And it's like, these women are crazy. And I got caught up in just all of the drama and all of the backbiting in the social circles and the screwing around and all these things that were going on. And I boiled it down and made a little screenplay out of it that had its own journey. And this close, like everything in LA, it was this close to getting
there. Sure,
it.
Yeah.
And I was having a conversation with my friend Mark, who was my last gay boyfriend in Boston. He was my roommate for a while. And he, too, was kind of like the whole... And I don't want to sound like a complete dick about what's... that people are too serious. But sometimes kind of there's a period where gay movies always end with somebody killing themselves because they're gay.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was a trope for a while.
Sure.
You know, and lesbian, much of the lesbian theater and movies that I've seen are very talky and processy and I'm like, why don't we ever get to laugh? Why don't we ever, why are our worlds so sad and need to be analyzed and discussed and torn apart? It's like, why can't we just live in a world where we sleep with people and have romances and function as normal people,
right,
so to speak? And when I wrote when I converted Girl Hopping to the stage, you know, I had to lose a lot of characters, and it was a great exercise in that I had to boil down really to the essences of the types that I was going for and the message that I was trying to send.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that, you know, that's really sort of, I guess you could say that I take things seriously, but I'm not necessarily serious about them.
I can see that, yeah. And having read a lot of your writing, I can see that, yeah.
You know, I think there's some really serious stuff in the world, and I think it goes down better with humor. I mean, I take on death a lot in stuff I've written too, mm-hmm. You know, because what's funnier
than death?
That's nothing.
Well, I mean, when we think about it, and we have to use comedy during moments of tragedy.
Besides, I'm Jewish. It's inherent in our kids. What we do. We eat and we die.
Well, you have that Italian mother.
My fake Italian mother.
What was her name again?
Shirley Constanza.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So you like to take on social themes, and I think you were alluding to this earlier, where it starts off as funny, and then it gets...
It takes a horrible, terrible
and then it takes,
turn.
But do you think that your formula of starting off funny and moving towards bringing in some of the dark elements, is that a formula for success for you as opposed to the reverse? Or if it started off really dark and then you have to bring all kinds of humor into it?
I've never tried that. That sounds fun. I think the two have to coexist, or, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with candy, because, you know, there's nothing better than something that's just funny from beginning to end.
Right.
It's just like, I don't have to think about any of that. That was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. But I find, at least for me, that when things are so serious all the time and there's no lightness in them, that I can't digest it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, maybe I'm shallow, but I you need a little bit of sugar with that. And even if it's a really dark joke, because it will still cut through, and you'll get like that, you know, sort of that, like, was that a flash of light? I don't know. Well, I guess I'll keep going a little further.
Right, yeah.
You know, and so, I don't know.
I think I once read a long time ago that even if something is labeled as a comedy, it needs some drama. If something is labeled as a drama, it needs some comedy. And that's just a reflection of the balance of, I think, real life.
And the creation of the unfortunate word dramedy.
I told you guys she was hilarious.
I'm also not wearing pants.
Right. She's wearing a hoop skirt. I'm wearing a pencil skirt. She's wearing a hoop skirt. And 12 petticoats.
Yes. It's a petticoat junction here.
Okay, so what do you think is an important direction that theater is taking right now that you can see?
I mean, you know, I love that there's finally some diversity, and that it's sort of the mainstreaming of diversity in a way, you know, aside from all finally people of different colors and backgrounds are starting to get a little bit of a voice.
Right.
There's also you know, people being less rigid in their casting, mm-hmm. which produces sort of, I think, an unintentional effect, but I think a really important one. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, you were talking about A Doll's House too, uh-huh. and, you know, was it?
Are you talking about the daughter?
Yeah. I was thinking, wait, did I just mix my plays up?
Because we've been on it.
Yeah.
You did.
And I thought.
Condola Rashad.
Yeah, Condola Rashad. And I was thinking, my head just sort of went to like, wait, was that? Because then I was thinking about Great Comet, and that also had a diverse cast. But I thought, this is awesome that here she is playing their daughter, and obviously they are of different races. And, mm-hmm. and that doesn't matter.
Yeah, I didn't bat an eye, and I don't think, you know, 99% of the audience even registered it.
And I think that in and of itself is the beginning of something greater, you mm-hmm. know, than it has to be old dead white men all the time.
Right.
You know. And also in terms of, I think, for us gays, mm-hmm. you know, the gay character is becoming less of a stereotype, less queeny, less butchy, less, you know, oh, isn't this, I'm gonna give you a makeover.
Right.
You know, and oh, look, the lesbian showed up to deliver the UPS package, you know. Like, it's beyond that.
Right.
And I think that's really neat. Mm-hmm. You know, that we can finally get, and not that we don't have a long way to go, because God knows we do, but.
Sure.
Those doors are starting to open, and hopefully there's room for everybody.
Right, right.
Right?
I was, I actually just posted this on somebody's wall this morning. I was reading Jane Lynch's book a couple of years ago, you know, from Glee. And, mm-hmm. And she wrote that every character is in every actor. It's just their job to do the creative work to create that character. Mm-hmm. You know, so you could effectively play, you know, as I know this is kind of, like right in front of me, but a tree, or you could play anything. It's there as long as you do the work to create it. And I think hopefully that's being realized a right. little bit more and respected a little bit more within casting companies mm-hmm. and producers. And I think A Doll's House is right. a perfect example of that. That, and I mean, all four of the actors are amazing, but she's a sensational
right.
actor.
Right.
She is. I don't know if you saw her in The Trip to Bountiful.
No, I did not.
Yeah, she was in The Trip to Bountiful, the Cicely Tyson production. Mm-hmm. She was phenomenal. She played, I think the character's name is Thelma, who, the nice lady that she right. meets on the bus, the one right. nice character in the whole play. but anyways, I have a little talent crush on her, so that's why I'm diverting a little bit from you to Condola.
That's all right. I've had a crush on Laurie Metcalf since I've been aware of her, so, and her performance in that.
Oh my gosh, she's killing it, right? Oh my jeez, I mean, finally she gets a play where it's like, I'm going to win every award, and she better.
Yeah, she better.
Yeah, otherwise, you know. It's going to be riots in Times Square. Yep. And then, you know, cocktails and dinner afterwards, right. naturally.
The new brunch, yes.
Exactly.
First we protest, then we get brunch.
what do you think is the best part of being involved in a small, intimate theater production? What's the fun of that, or the advantage?
Well, honestly, it's been a long time since I've been part of one of those.
Okay.
And the fact that I miss it says... You know, it's the intimacy not only with the audience but with the community, your own community, the players and the company. That's like, what's the word I'm looking for?
The ensemble.
Yeah, well,
ensemble.
The ensemble, but as well as just the company of, you know, the person who's doing the box office and running the lights.
Sure.
And, you know, a million years ago in Boston. There was this theater called the Back Alley Theater, and it's where an improv troupe, not my improv troupe, but another improv troupe, used to do their shows at 10:30 after, like, the little storefront theater show. Uh-huh. So they would do a 10:30 show after that.
Wow.
But it was like this little tiny space, and you had to like climb up to the lighting booth was this little tiny, you know, bird's nest, and
been there, done that.
And there's something about being young and being part of that community and like, can you come in and do lights for us tonight? Because we, you know, that sort of, when you got a phone call.
Right.
Someone, I left you a message on your machine, because that's how long ago it was. you know, there's something about that intimacy there
right.
that is really extraordinary. And, you know, I mean, I work in TV too, and that exists, except with union delineation as opposed to who's touching the lights.
Right.
But, you know, you get onto a production sometimes and you get that same sense of it's us and then the audience and we're all kind of in this tiny little world and it's this sweet little bubble. And, you know, I miss it. It's just, it hasn't been something that I've found, that I've made time for mm-hmm. or that I've sought out really while living in New York, because my life has just taken sort of a tack away from that
right.
current.
Well, what's interesting is that you give that answer, but that's a very common answer to yeah. this question.
I'm sure.
Is the teamwork yeah. aspect of it, where, you know, you're taking tickets and then you're climbing into the light booth. Right. You know, then afterwards you're sweeping and cleaning toilets. Right. I mean,
and then you're drinking beer.
Right. And then you're going out afterwards. my husband always says, my husband David, the first plays that he did outside of school were in a strip mall. It was a theater and a strip mall behind a tattoo parlor.
Fantastic.
Which I think is just, like, yeah. so super funny.
Well, that's how the back alley was. There was, like, a downstairs. You had to, like, climb a ladder to get to the stage, and there was a stink. No one, I think it was, there was a rumor was, the mythology was there was a dead rat somewhere in the, like, walls of the, yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah. you know, you barely had enough money to put on the production, right. much less knock out the wall yeah, and get the gonna, rat out of there. So you just, you know.
Not
just,
in Cambridge.
You just.
That gonna, rat had a right to be there. This was Cambridge.
Right. You just continue to drop right. like a glade stick.
Exactly. Right?
It's hilarious. What do you think every theatrical artist, writer, actor, director should be doing right now to be relevant and successful in the industry?
I don't know. That's a really small, specific question you're asking.
Is it?
What? What do you want me to know?
What should every theatrical artist, writer, actor, director,
right.
be doing right now to be relevant and successful in the industry?
That's a gigantic question. And I am the last
thank you.
Person.
I work out.
You should see his guns. Yeah. And his pencil skirt. I have a very short answer to that.
Okay.
And it was a piece of advice given to me by a mentor when I was working in public television in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
This phenomenal woman who used to call me Babe, and I used to call her Babe. She'd call me, she'd go, Babe, it's Babe. and she had a very strong influence on me early in my career. And I was working for her at one point, and I was mid-late 20s, and I didn't know which way was up. And she looked at me, and she said to me, Babe, be true to your truth.
Mm.
And that has been a guiding principle of my life. And I think, really, as artists, it's about truth.
Right.
And my truth is different than your truth, is different than David's truth, is different than my wife's truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you know what your truth is and you remain true to it, then everything comes from there.
Hmm. Can you give an example of, and you don't have to if you don't want to, of where that's worked for you?
I think when I sit down, when I'm really knee-deep in writing something, and I have all these characters talking to me, and they're telling me their truths. And,
interesting.
You know, that's, you know, if you want to get metaphorical and esoteric here, improv is based on trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't. And let's go to the cheesiest, most awful theater exercise there is: the trust fall. Stupidest thing in the world.
Right.
We all hate them because all of us in our hearts don't trust.
Right.
And not that we ever did trust falls when we were doing improv together, but knowing that I'm in a scene and I'm having a problem and I know that I need someone else to come in and do something, and then they do it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, trust and truth and trusting and trustfulness. I think they're all kind of, they are all interconnected. I mean, it's all the same root word. And I think that's, you know, the kernel that propels us forwards as artists. You know, one of the big rules in improv is honesty, which is, of course, the side of truth. You know, that when you're trying to make stuff up, you're not funny. But if you blurt something out that comes from some truth deep within you, that it's going to resonate. It's going to land on everybody because it's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, some kind of put on, I look at me being clever and no one's more clever than me. But it's me telling you the truth.
Except me.
Except Sean. And he looks dashing in a pencil skirt. But that, you know when you see something and if, you know, I mean, there's another buzzword, authentic. Like all of that, as hokey as it sounds, I think is really what people have to do. And we're living in precarious times. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, there's the alternative truths out there. And we have to be true to our truth. And I think that is a guiding light.
Well, and it also sounds like what you're talking about is being okay with dropping the defenses and being vulnerable, and trusting that, and because that's where the truth comes from. And a lot of people have a hard time with that.
Yeah,
they just, and you can tell when an actor is being open opposed to when they're closed off in a show. I mean, you could just tell right away. And we can tell, and we could probably label it, but an average audience member may not be able to do that. They just sense that something's weird, something's not right.
Right.
The truth is not there.
Right.
So I think that is one of my favorite answers so far.
Shucks. especially in improv, because sometimes you have an idea, and like the worst thing you can have in improv is an idea. And someone's over here, and they've created their little space. They're in their little hamburger joint, and they're making their burgers. And someone has this idea, and they come in, and this is, you know, classic denial, and they ignore the idea that's already being softly developed, or they take it and they have an agenda with it, and it loses its whatever that little sweetness was that was started, and it's kind of the same thing. It's like, now you've taken it with this, you're taking it to this place that it never intended to go.
Right.
And it feels false. It feels put on.
Mm-hmm.
It feels disingenuous. All of those, you know. And as an audience member, you're like, exactly, you're like, I don't know what just happened, but I don't think it was right.
Right.
You know, where anybody in the audience who's done improv, because that's usually who goes to see improv. Oh, I'm in an improv troupe. We used to have a courtesy that if you were an improv troupe, you didn't have to pay. So that was part of it. Those days are over. But you're like, oh, he just did, you know, you can name it. Like anything else, when the rules are broken, if you know what the rules are, you can name it. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you're like, that didn't seem legal. That didn't seem like the right thing to do when that hockey player did that to that other hockey player. I think there's a penalty for that, you know.
Oh, exactly.
So it's yeah.
Well, there's an alchemy to performing, to acting, that it's very, very difficult and it's very precarious. And I think that it is based in truth and it is based in vulnerability. That's a wonderful answer, because most people are saying, you know, go out there and connect.
Right.
Find a mentor, or say yes to everything. I mean, and what you're giving is a very...
It's one step back from that.
Right, it is.
You have to do that before you can... Because if you don't know what your truth is, you're not going to find the right person to help you.
Exactly. Precisely. So that's great. I mean, no shade to any of my other answers. I love all of them. But that is very, very, very smart and extremely well thought out. Okay. Before we wrap up, you want to do a speed round with me?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Okay. What's your favorite play?
You know, I don't have a sort of an all-time favorite play. I will tell you that I just saw Sweat and it blew my mind.
Okay. Cool. Favorite musical?
That's easy. A Chorus Line.
I
saw it in Chicago in the 80s. My mother took me for like my 16th birthday and that. I'm sorry. It's hokey. But that play blew my mind.
High five. I fucking love that show. It's so... Sorry, I said the F word. I don't think I've ever said the F word on the show, but again...
I bring out the worst in
right.
people.
I remember seeing it here at the Pantages Theater, and one of the guys that was in it went to my high school, and I was here with my... It was my drama school trip, right. My drama drama class trip, and we got to go backstage.
Oh, wow.
And I was tripping. I was like, right. Oh my... I met him, I met... Dana Morales, somebody else, I forget, but I think that musical is genius.
It is. It's because it's simple and it's true.
It's no, exactly. That is their truth. And also I met Donna McKechnie.
Oh, you little
But not then. Right. I met her a couple years ago at a Pride Films and Plays event she came out and she was a guest and she was super, super sweet. And I love that musical as well. Okay, do you have a favorite writer?
What kind of writer? I mean,
any kind.
I'm going to answer Nora Ephron because that seems like a good answer.
Oh, Nora Ephron did a lot of things.
Yes, she did.
She wrote plays. She wrote screenplays.
And that's why she's a hero of mine.
Right.
As well as Flannery O'Connor.
Okay. Cool. There you go.
Weird but true.
That's all right. You can have co-favorite writers.
Yes.
How about your favorite director?
I'm assuming when I hear director, you mean film, or do you mean
either whatever you want? I'm like my favorite director is Mike Nichols, but he did film.
He does everything.
He did. He's gone.
That's a good one.
God rest his soul. I loved him.
I have several. Peter Bogdanovich is one, and Barry Levinson is another.
Oh, cool! Excellent. Do you have a mentor?
Not currently.
Okay. That's fine. Groovy. Okay. Well, before we wrap up, why don't you tell us if there's anything that you'd like to mention that you've been working on lately or that you'd like to start up or revisit?
You want to hear the toilet joke?
Yes. Yes. Let's hear the toilet joke. Okay. She's pivoting, but that's all right.
So this guy, like that's literally how it starts. So this guy.
Okay, good.
Paints the house green. Paints the whole house green. Paints the living room green. Paints the dining room green. Paints the bedroom green. Paints the bathroom green. Paints the toilet seat green. Unbeknownst to his wife, who was out bowling, comes home at 3 o'clock in the morning, has a seat on the wet-painted toilet seat, and gets stuck. She starts screaming hysterically. Her husband comes back into the bathroom, cannot pry her up, necessity being the mother of invention, goes to the toolbox, gets a monkey wrench and a screwdriver, unscrews the toilet seat, picks up his wife and the toilet seat, brings her in the bedroom, puts her in the bed face down, calls the doctor. The doctor shows up. He pulls down the cover, and he says, "Doctor, what do you think of that?" And the doctor says, "It's beautiful, but did you have to frame it?" And as my mother used to say, and that's what kept us out of the big time. Follow me on Twitter. I'm hilarious. I.A. Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R.
She's peeking at my script here. Are there any other social media sites you like?
That's my main one.
Okay.
Is Twitter.
Tell us again.
I.A. Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R.
And are you on it all the time?
I'm on it plenty.
Okay, good.
I have a big mouth.
No.
I know. I'd like to be snarky. That's where I'm snarkiest, is on Twitter.
Okay, well, thank you, Eileen. You're awesome.
Sure, I'll go on.
Okay, now even though you did the toilet joke, which right. you said you were going to do on the next show.
I know. Now I'll have to come up. I'll tell the astronaut joke next time.
Okay, all right, there. I just wanted a commitment that you'd be back. Oh, so.
They're demanding it. I can hear them in the streets. Or that's another protest.
Right. You were marvelous.
Oh, go on.
And just fabulous.
Go on.
I would, but I have to wrap it up. Okay. So at the end of the show, I like to give shout-outs to current productions I recommend. And on tonight's show, I'm recommending a Broadway show that is close to both Eileen and myself. It's called Bandstand. It's a great new musical out here on Broadway. It stars Laura Osnes and Corey Cott and a brilliant team of musicians, cast, and crew. And its storyline deals with the big band music of the 1940s with such themes weaved in as friendship, war, and post-traumatic stress disorder. It's directed and choreographed by Tony Winner, Andy Blankenbuehler of the Hamilton fame.
Never heard of it.
Please. He's the choreographer of Hamilton, but he directed and choreographed this show. And I actually saw another show that he did double duty on, you were thinking it, I know. And that was a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and it was really, really good. I loved it. Saw that in L.A. It has book and lyrics by Bob Taylor and Richard Oberacker, and the music is by Richard Oberacker. I love that name. Eileen and I have a friend named Adam Wolf, who is a percussionist who plays in the orchestra pit.
It's true.
And I say that because not only is there an orchestra, but part of the story is a formation of a band of World War II veterans, and the guys who are in that band actually play the instruments, and Corey Cott plays the piano. So anyways, it's a wonderful show with edifying themes that really hit home with the audience when I was there. In fact, there was a moment, I won't give it away, when one of the actors gave a monologue about serving in the military, and the audience like flat out cheered. They're like, yes! It has received 2 Tony Award nominations for Best Choreography for Blankenbuehler and Best Orchestrations for Bill Elliott and Greg Anthony Rassen, both fabulous. Both of those nominations in those categories. And it was just announced that the show has been nominated for 5 Broadway.com Audience Choice Awards, including Favorite New Musical, Leading Actor and Actress for Osnes and Cott, and Favorite Onstage Pair for the same couple, and Favorite Diva Performance for Laura Osnes. Now, what I understand, she's not a diva at all, but I mean only in behavior. She is becoming, like, she's like a baby diva. Why? That's how I describe her. Anyways.
That a David? A baby diva?
No. David is a major diva. It's playing here in New York at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater on 45th. Please visit their website at bandstandbroadway.com for tickets and show details. It's a great show, and I loved it. It was wonderful. Well, folks, a proverbial 11 o'clock number has been sung, and the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain.
Hey, there's a curtain. Hey, you didn't tell me it was real.
I'd like to thank my guest, the sensational Eileen Fisher.
Go on.
That was her. If you'd like for me to give you a shout-out about your show or your production company or whatever in your area, or a mention of your organization, go to my Facebook page at facebook.com/yourprogramisyourticket. You can also follow me on Twitter at programticket. And give my website a visit at yourprogramisyourticket.com. And it would be best to send me an email, or you can give me a like and shoot me a message or what have you. Everyone knows a million ways we can connect, and I will talk about you and happily. Folks,
then he'll talk about you behind your back.
No, I won't. Never like this. Stop that. Folks, take a little time to see a show this week, and don't forget to give a smaller show some love. There's a lot of theater gems out there. Until our next show, good night, theater people. And curtain.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.